Today is Friday, 20th February 2026, and before I begin with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If, once you have watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, as of today, Friday, 20th February 2026, we have the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, which continues, and where it seems to me that the outcome is no longer in any serious doubt. And then we have the completely different conflict, which is about to start in the Middle East, in the Gulf, between the United States and Israel and Iran. I'm going to start with the conflict in the Middle East. We are at that very difficult moment before a conflict begins, before a war starts, when each side seems to be manoeuvring and where each side is making its own preparations before the start of the war. I discussed some days ago about the fact that the Iranians have now carried out what clearly looks like a rehearsal for the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, and the way in which the Russians seem to be rushing oil supplies to China, which looked to me also like possibly anticipating a closure of the Straits of Hormuz. And we also have the deployment of Russian naval ships as part of these exercises that are taking place in the Arabian Sea. And it turns out around the Straits of Hormuz as well. Exercises carried out by the Iranian Navy with the Russians also involved. There are also reports that the Chinese are involved in these exercises as well. But so far, interestingly, no confirmation that Chinese warships have yet joined the grouping, the Iranian and Russian grouping of ships in the Straits of Hormuz. And that is interesting. It suggests that the Chinese are busy at the moment with further deployments, though it is important to say that formally the Chinese are also participating in this exercise, and I, for one, expect that Chinese military officials are present in these Iranian and Russian warships, and that eventually we will probably see Chinese warships deployed in this area too. Now, I am going to suggest that the reason we have not yet seen actual deployment of Chinese warships in these exercises is that the Chinese, in light of the events of the last few weeks, are readjusting their plans and are intending to send more powerful warships to the area than had been originally planned. To repeat a point which I have made in earlier programs, the force that is participating in these exercises, the Russian and Iranian naval force, is relatively small. In fact, I believe that the Russian presence is made up of a single Russian Navy corvette, what would be classified in the West as a small frigate. Hardly a ship that, frankly, can counter the gargantuan naval deployments to this territory by the United States, to this area by the United States, the aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, its three or perhaps more Aegis-class destroyers, the nuclear submarine that is also said to be in this area, the various other very, very much more powerful warships that the United States has deployed to the Arabian Sea. the Russians at the moment probably do not have the means to deploy more powerful forces than the naval corvette they have at their disposal. The Russian Navy is a powerful navy by comparison with those of the countries of Western Europe. The Russians in particular have a very powerful and very advanced nuclear submarine force, but they do not have a blue water ocean-going navy of the kind that the United States does. Certainly not the kind of navy that could conduct sustained operations in places like the Arabian Sea. China does. It has aircraft carriers, powerful destroyers comparable to the American Aegis-class destroyers, and many other warships as well. So if China wants to send a task force to the Arabian Sea, it is able to do so. In fact, in its totality, the Chinese Navy now has more warships than the US Navy does, though, of course, the United States still has a major numerical advantage in terms of aircraft carriers. Just saying. So I think that the Chinese are holding back because they are currently reviewing their plans and they're asking themselves whether they should send more powerful warships than they originally intended. And perhaps there are plans eventually to send a more powerful Chinese fleet to this area, though naval deployments take days or weeks to materialise. And even if the decision to send more powerful Chinese warships were made today, it would still take probably around 10 days to 2 weeks before the Chinese ships arrived. In the meantime, it's important to remember that the Chinese are there already in the Arabian Sea, though the naval assets they have are spy ships which are keeping track on what the Americans are doing. And of course, the Chinese have large numbers of satellites that are observing the situation in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. The Russians also have satellites as well, though not as many as the Chinese, and their primary focus will be on observing, monitoring the continental United States, Europe, and of course the situation in Ukraine. But anyway, all of this is now taking place, and all of these movements are taking place. But the fact that the exercises, the Russian-Iranian exercises, do appear to extend to the Straits of Hormuz itself is interesting. It's important to reiterate, however, that the exercises are part of a scheduled list of naval exercises between Russia, China and Iran that go back, have been planned and have been organised over several years. Now, I have received a whole cluster of emails from various people with extensive military expertise and who have been discussing this war. Some of them have come from the United States. Some of the most interesting commentaries have come from former officers with or senior technicians in India who have also been monitoring these operations. Anyway, the major thing to say is that the naval assets that the US is deploying are very impressive. The aircraft assets that the US is deploying also are enormously impressive. But the decisive advantage that the three great powers have is in their satellite guidance and monitoring systems, GPS, GLONASS, which is the Russian equivalent, and the Chinese equivalent as well, whose name, by the way, I forget. It is these arrays which provide the Americans, the Russians, and the Chinese the decisive ability to control events on a battlefield, to conduct precise strikes, to guide their missiles onto specific targets, and to coordinate their forces. All three of these great powers possess these capabilities. They were pioneered by the United States and first used by the United States in the 1991 operations against Iran. But both Russia and China now have these capabilities as well. You could almost say that along with possession of large stockpiles of nuclear weapons and long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear submarines, it is these command and control and surveillance capabilities that make these three great powers, the three great military powers of the present day. And of course, that then brings us back to the kind of capabilities that the Iranians are being offered by their great power allies, China and Russia. And it seems that for some time, for several years in fact, the Chinese have been pressing Iran to transition completely away from the American system, GPS, which used to be the system that was mostly used in Iran, or indeed at one time entirely used in Iran, over to Chinese, to the Chinese system, both for monitoring and organizing and coordinating Iranian forces, but also to provide guidance in terms of operations against external forces as well. And it seems that this transition is now indeed taking place. In fact, it began some time ago. Obviously, I'm talking about the military, the Iranian military here. But apparently, it is far from complete. And that is another advantage that the United States still has over Iran in case of this showdown. To be precise, the Chinese are prepared to make their system, have offered their system, placed their system at the disposal of the Chinese, of the Iranians, but the Iranians are only in the process of transitioning to it. And this brings me back to that earlier discussion I had about a week ago about how the Russians appear to be taking steps to help the Chinese, the Iranians, increase the accuracy and the precision of their missiles. Again, given that I know that the Russian and Chinese systems, satellite systems, satellite guidance systems, are interchangeable, I think it's highly likely that this is what a lot of this assistance that the Russians are providing to the Iranians in terms of the precision and guidance of their missiles is all about. So one can see again the urgency on the American side, why there is this pressure from the Americans and the Iranians, or at least from some people within Israel and Iran, Israel and the United States to complete this operation as soon as possible. Because with every month that passes, the Iranians are getting more organized, more advanced, more ready to counter whatever attack is brought against them. And when I say counter whatever attack is brought against them, counter it in a way that might lead to strikes against targets, Israeli and American targets, across the Middle East. Now, reports have appeared in the United States about the United States providing warnings to nations in southeastern Europe, NATO states in southeastern Europe, that the Iranians have the missile range to strike targets in southeastern Europe, and in the event of a crisis in the Middle East, a major conflict, it cannot be excluded that the Iranians might do precisely that. Now, the Iranians would not be attacking Bulgarian or Romanian targets. They would be attacking American bases located in these countries. And this is a real possibility, in my opinion. I understand that these bases are very, very short of air defense. Such air defense assets as the United States has, it has mostly concentrated now in the Middle East. So we can get the growing sense of the way in which this war or potential war is expanding, the degree to which the conflict has the ability to expand beyond the Middle East. I am sure that the Russians and the Chinese will try to explain to the Iranians that attacks on targets in Southeast Europe is not in Iran's advantage, that it will expand the war and might cause the Europeans to join in. And I think it most unlikely that the Russians and the Chinese would provide the Iranians with the satellite guidance facilities that I talked about to guide their missiles to strike that, to strike targets in southeastern Europe. But the Iranians against that have said that if they are attacked, they will strike in every way and in every place that they can. And I don't myself think that this possibility of a strike on targets in southeastern Europe can be completely excluded. I know that some people are rushing to say as much, but frankly, I don't agree with them. Anyway, we shall see. We are still in this very, very complex game. The American military assets are growing in scale and number, and we are told that the United States now has as many air and naval assets deployed close to Iran as was the case ahead of the wars that the United States waged against Iraq, though I'm not sure which war is being referred to, whether it was the 1991 war or the 2003 war. Now, I am going to make here a very general observation about the nature of those wars, the wars the United States waged against Iraq, and, by the way, Iran's own history in terms of wars. There are continuing rumours that the United States might be contemplating some kind of ground operation against Iran in support of whatever bombing or missile campaign it might be planning. I have to say that for the moment, I don't think the United States has deployed enough troops, actual troops, to the area to do anything like that in a way that could seriously amount to a ground invasion. I think for the moment, if there are any plans to use troops, they would probably be special forces. Already, by the way, an extremely risky enterprise. If any of these people are captured by the Iranians, then it would be extremely embarrassing and potentially very dangerous. And the Iranians, again, might not be as inhibited in what they do with their captives as, say, the Russians are. Just saying. But more likely, at least the indications for the moment suggest that the primary attack on Iran will take air and missile strikes against Iran by the United States and Israel. Now, putting aside whatever help China and Russia are giving, putting aside what an Iranian air defense system might achieve, and the scale and effectiveness of any Iranian strikes against American targets and Israeli targets in the Middle East. It's perhaps important to say that up to this time, the record of air and missile strikes in terms of overthrowing regimes, achieving regime change, has been far from good. I'm not saying that it has never happened, but it has not happened very often. And if we're talking about Iraq, well, the United States conducted a massive, relentless bombing campaign against Iran ahead of the 1991 military operations. But that bombing campaign did not lead to the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime, nor did Operation Desert Fox in 1998 cause the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. In fact, it should be said that for most of the 1990s, pretty much every day in the 1990s, the Americans were bombing some target in Iran, in Iraq, somewhere. And even in 2003, when the United States conducted its shock and awe attack against Iran, preparatory to the invasion that took place then, well, that too didn't lead to the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. An actual ground invasion by a very, very powerful force made up of several US divisions was required in order to do that. And if we're talking about Iran, Iran also has endured intense bombing from the air to an extent that is widely forgotten. But during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, especially in the later part of that war, when Iraq was receiving extensive assistance, primarily, by the way, from the Soviet Union. I remember that Iraq conducted a sustained campaign against the Iranian cities, that there was very heavy bombing of those cities, including by Tupolev 22 bombers supplied by the Soviet Union, which dropped on the city's enormous 9-ton bombs, also, by the way, supplied by the Soviet Union. And Iraq was also conducting heavy strikes on Iranian cities using long-range missiles launched from Iraq. Now, the point was that this war on the cities did massive damage and killed many people in Iran, but it did not lead to the collapse of the government there. So Iran has a history of enduring very heavy bombing and missile campaigns. Now, in the 1980s, the revolution against the Shah was recent memory. The ruler of Iran was the charismatic figure of who had founded Iran's Islamic Republic and who had led the revolution against the Shah, Ayatollah Khomeini. It may be that the Iran of the 1980s had more power of endurance than the very different, much more complex society in some ways that Iran today has. I am unable to make comparisons, but just to repeat again, the objective of this attack, this pending attack, when it comes, is clearly regime change in Iran. If regime change is not achieved, then the attack will have failed. And there are many claims as to how long Israel and the United States can conduct this missile and bombing campaign on Iran. Some say a week, some say 2 weeks. Let's say it's a month, but it's unlikely that it can be continued at the same level of intensity for much longer, especially if Russian and Chinese aid to Iran continues. So what Iran needs to do is to survive that month, and it was able to survive, well, I think it was about a whole year of heavy bombing by Iraq in the 1980s. I wonder whether it is realistic to expect that the entire government and the entire political system in Iran is going to collapse in the space of, let's say, a few weeks or a month. And if we go back and compare the American bombing and missile strike attacks on Iraq, which, to repeat again, did not achieve regime change in Iraq, if we look at the situation with Iran, then there are further problems. Iran is a far bigger country than Iraq in territorial terms. It's got an extremely complex geography. Much of it is made up of very high mountains, very, very different from Iraq. Iran has many more cities, big cities, than Iraq does. And these are located at enormous distances from each other. American and Israeli fighter jets, if they're able to operate over Iranian airspace, and it's perhaps worth pointing out that if Iran's air defense system continues to function, and the longer the operation continues for, if Iran starts getting assistance with the operation of its air defense system from China and Russia, that air defense system might actually gradually begin to improve, just say, over the course of the war. But anyway, the American and Israeli aircraft would have to cover vastly greater distances, reach out many more places than they ever had to do in Iraq, where the airspace was smaller and the vital targets were much more concentrated. Lastly, I should say that I understand that already, because of the threat of Iranian missiles, the US is positioning its navy further from Iran than it would optimally seek to do. And the fact that so many air refueling tankers have been deployed by the United States to the Middle East might also suggest that the American and Israeli air assets against Iran are going to have to be deployed from long distances. That might make it more difficult to maintain attacks because aircraft have to fly over longer distances and refuel, and that might create all sorts of complexities. And Larry Johnson, I think it was, on Sonar 2021, pointed out that whilst aircraft, including stealth aircraft, are refueling, they become more vulnerable to attack, perhaps by long-range surface-to-air missiles, some of which do nowadays have very, very long ranges. So that, of course, assumes that those missile batteries are functioning and that the radars that guide those missiles are functioning as well. Anyway, all I am saying is this. This is looking to me, from all of the information that I'm getting, to be a very complex and very difficult operation. It hinges on the fragility or apparent fragility of the Iranian government. If assumptions about that are wrong, then I, for one, can see how this could turn into a debacle. Now, I'm not making predictions here. It may be that the government is every bit as fragile as some people in the United States and Israel and in Europe believe. And as I've discussed in many programs, there are some reasons to think so. But it is high risk. And the risks for the United States and for President Trump himself, if things go wrong, are extraordinarily high. I remember how about a week before the start of Ukraine's 2023 summer offensive in Zaporozhye region, a report appeared in, I think it was the New York Times, which said that Joe Biden himself and his officials were becoming increasingly nervous about the offensive. They worried that if the offensive failed, and they were beginning to understand that there was a real possibility that the offensive might fail, that if the Ukrainian offensive in the summer of 2023 failed, then Biden's authority would be shot to pieces, that the entire purpose of his administration in foreign policy and international relations terms would be gone, that the entire neocon project that was associated with Joe Biden, a globalist neocon project, would be discredited, and that Biden's own position, including within the United States itself, would be damaged, perhaps beyond retrieval. Well, as we know, the offensive did fail. It fell disastrously. And I think a very strong case could be said that from that point on, for Biden, for the Democrats, it was downhill all the way. A few months later, Biden imploded, and by the time the November 2024 election came, He was gone. Well, is it that different with Donald Trump if this operation against Iran succeeds? And at the moment, for the moment, I could see that it might be every bit as problematic, or perhaps even more problematic than Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive was, if this operation against Iran fails, he politically will surely be held under the waterline. It'll be difficult to take him seriously in foreign policy terms. The neocons and the Israelis and their various allies in Washington will be furious with him. And, well, I have to say that at that point, his chances of success in the midterms are pretty much shot to pieces. And, well, frankly, I think that from that moment, it will all be downhill for him. And by this time next year, if he's still president, he will be president mostly in name rather than fact. Now, it could be that some realization of this explains some of the rather strange things we have seen coming out of Washington over the last few hours. Firstly, we had reports that the United States, that the US military would be ready to launch attacks on Iran on Saturday, in other words, tomorrow. Then we had a report in the Wall Street Journal that the United States, the Donald Trump to be precise, was thinking first of a limited strike against Iran, a strike against Iran to bring Iran to its senses, to get the Iranians to understand that he was serious and that he really does mean it when he says that he wants Iran to give up enrichment entirely and to do away with its entire stockpile of ballistic missiles, or at least to cap their range. Demands which I have said already the Iranians will never accept. I think that this could be misdirection. It could be that the Americans are spreading stories about a limited strike because they are aware that the Iranians have said that even the most limited strike carried out against them now will be treated by Iran as the start of an all-out war, and that Iran will respond accordingly and will strike wherever it can against American and Israeli targets in all directions. It might be that the Americans are trying to give the Iranians, create doubts for the Iranians about the purpose of an initial strike in order to dissuade the Iranians from doing that. In which case, by the way, I should quickly say that I am sure that will not work. But there must at least be a possibility that all of this talk about limited strikes by the United States simply portrays the ingrowing nervousness of Donald Trump and of some of his advisers, that they're starting to have fears that this might not turn out as well as they expected, with all of the catastrophic political consequences if this goes wrong, that they are aware that they've now got themselves into a situation where they have to strike Iran, but they're looking for some way to pull their punches. It's the kind of idea that gets floated around when people are nervous, are starting to doubt the commitment that they have already made, that when they're looking in some way to pull back. And I do wonder whether some of that is now going on. We've subsequently had another statement from Donald Trump himself. He says that he's giving Iran a 10-day deadline to come to terms, to capitulate in effect to his demands. We've seen the deadlines for Donald Trump don't mean anything. The fact that he says that the Iranians have 10 days to come to their senses, as he would say, doesn't mean that an attack might not come tomorrow or next week or in 100 days. Trump often gives deadlines which shouldn't be taken too seriously. But for the record, maybe, just maybe, this is again another attempt by Trump to postpone the decision. And then we've had the most bizarre thing of all, this sudden announcement by Trump out of the blue that he's going to publish everything, all the information that the US government has about aliens, about people from outer space. I mean, it seems on its face a very, very strange thing to do at a moment of crisis like this. And again, it's the sort of thing, if I have to be honest, which I tend to associate with people who are now under extreme worry and stress. Anyway, I may be wrong. It may be that, as I said, the decision has been made, the attack will happen tomorrow, that Trump and the people around him are cocky and full of confidence. It may be, by the way, that they have grounds for being cocky and full of confidence, that they have information coming from Iran that tells them with certainty that the collapse of the government of Iran is a certainty if the attack takes place, that Iran is indeed just a house of cards, all of which will collapse as soon as Trump and the American military blow upon it. But as I said many times, I'm somebody who is very used to seeing signs of stress and of nervousness. And these do look to me a little bit like that. Anyway, the Iranians, for their part, are still going through the pretense that the negotiations have some meaning. They're saying that they're putting together some kind of written proposal or framework that they're going to present to the Americans. They still insist that the talks in Geneva went extremely well, even though nothing was actually agreed. My sense is that in Washington, they feel very much the other way, that the talks in Geneva went nowhere at all and were a disaster. But then, of course, with all of this assistance from the Chinese and to some extent from the Russians arriving, with Iran itself making whatever preparations it can, it is obviously in China, in Iran's interests to play for time. If Chinese warships are indeed coming, then of course it is in Iran's interests to play for time. And that is, I suspect, why this continuing charade of the negotiations continues to take place. Well, there it is, a very, very high-risk gamble by this administration, one which, based on history, perhaps carries an enormous question mark over it. There is no doubt that within Iran itself, there is significant opposition to the government. But Larry Johnson, again on Sonar 21, published some opinion polls that independent agencies have made in Iran, and these do strongly suggest that for all the economic problems, which by the way continue, in Iran, the governmental system there continues to have legitimacy and a critical mass of support of the people. And I read a very interesting, very revealing article in the Financial Times, which said that that is the Iranian government's own calculation, that they believe that if they acceded to the American demands, regime change would become a certainty. The authority and legitimacy of the government in Iran would be destroyed. And with Iran giving up its ballistic missiles, its deterrence capability will have gone. Whereas an attack on Iran, an outright attack on Iran, as happened during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, and as also happened in the American-Israeli attack on Iran in June last year, will have a consolidating effect on Iranian society and will strengthen the government. And if, of course, the government is able to continue and wage a long war, it might even have a good chance of coming through the winner. So anyway, we can only wait and see. We can only wait and see how things play out over the next few weeks. But certainly, and I'm going to say this, Donald Trump has placed himself in a position which no president of the United States should ever position himself in. Ronald Reagan, for example, would never have put himself in a position of this kind. And by the way, for all his reputation for belligerence when he was president, never did. When presidents have gambled in the way that George W. Bush did with the Iraq War and Joe Biden did with the Ukraine War and specifically with the summer 2023 offensive, it hasn't turned out well for them. And I can't really see why Donald Trump assumes that this one will turn out well for him either, especially since he's starting a war of choice, which there is no pressing need from an American perspective to start now. A war which many people in the United States will, in my opinion, rightly say is being waged not for American interests, but for Israeli ones. In other words, for the interests of a different country. But there it is. As I said in another program, one that Alex and I did on the Duran, we are passengers on this train. We can only await events and comment and analyze them. Our voice, all of our voices, might eventually come into play and be heard. And that makes analysis at this particular time important. But the decisions whether to start this war or not are being made by only a very small group of people, by Donald Trump first and foremost. And anyway, we shall see what comes. Anyway, let's now turn to the other conflict, the conflict in Ukraine. And we've had more revelations about what happened in Geneva this week during the supposed negotiations there. And the Daily Telegraph has a piece saying that the Ukrainians really were stunned, shocked, appalled by Medinsky's conduct over the course of the negotiations. When I say Medinsky's conduct, I want to say very clearly that I'm not in any way suggesting that Medinsky, the chief Russian negotiator, acted in any aggressive or improper way. I've seen Medinsky in action. He's always careful and polite. I don't expect that over the course of the meeting he at any point raised his voice, just to say, or used inappropriate language, or banged the table in front of him, or did any of these showy and improper things. But the point is that he obviously didn't give an inch. He made it absolutely clear, as the Russians have repeatedly said, that the Russians are sticking with their demands. The demands being the ones that Putin set out in his speech to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024, that which we on the Duran, and a few others, by the way, as I've now seen, always referred to as Istanbul Plus. And obviously, there has been some sort of agreement between the Americans and the Russians that was made in Anchorage. The Russians harp on about it. I'm not sure what that was, but the one thing that I think we can be fairly confident about is that the Americans agreed with the Russians in Anchorage that the Ukrainians must at the very least withdraw from Donbass, something that the Ukrainians up to now categorically refuse to do. And the Russians have said that they're going to stick to that agreement that they made with the Americans, whatever it was. And I'm confident that Medinsky also made that point to the Ukrainians. And I think he made it absolutely clear that Donbass is not up for negotiation. The Ukrainians must completely pull out. These ideas about demilitarized free trade zones in Donbass are totally unacceptable to Moscow, that the Russians are not prepared to bargain on the status of the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. That is unequivocally Russian as well. The Russians might be prepared to provide Ukraine with electricity from the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, but they're certainly not there to negotiate on its status. And I'm sure that Medinsky made all that clear over the course of the discussions in Geneva. Incidentally, the other big important Russian negotiator in Geneva, Kirill Dmitriev, the head of Russia's Direct Investment Fund, the person who is engaging in trade and economic talks directly with Steve Witkoff, he's now come out and said that the stories that have been circulating in Bloomberg and particularly in The Economist, that the Russians have floated some kind of trade pact with the United States worth $12 trillion, allowing for the US to re-enter the Russian economy, for the Russians to start using the dollar again on a regular basis, for the Russians to basically give up their entire program of developing an indigenous civil aviation fleet, even as they are doing tests on their two new passenger jets, the Sukhoi, well, it's now the Yakovlev Superjet, and the MS-21. And as the Russians are completing development of their various new engines, aircraft engines. Anyway, Dmitriev says that all of those reports, all of those stories are fake news, that the Russians have never made any such proposals. I suspect that these proposals were floated by people in the United States, that it's the Americans again who are coming up with these ideas as kind of bribes to try to get the Russians to moderate their terms over the conflict in Ukraine. But anyway, Dmitriev says that we can disregard all of those stories. And of course, what Dmitriev is saying has also been said by Peskov. Peskov, for example, said that the Russians have never refused to use the dollar in settlements. It's the Americans who prevented them from doing so. And if the Americans want the Russians to use the dollar in some settlements, well, that's up to them. But obviously, that's not going to cause the Russians to change their policies with respect to the various payment systems that the BRIC states are busy working on. By the way, since I'm on the topic of all of these economic matters, we've now had some statements from India. It turns out that the Indian Foreign Minister, Mr. Jaishankar, who was present at the Munich Security Conference, when asked about whether it was true that India was ceasing imports of Russian oil, said that India makes its own sovereign decisions, and sometimes it makes decisions which its Western partners might not like. That wasn't a straight denial that India is going to stop buying Russian oil, but it's a hint that the claims from the Americans that the Indians have made some commitment to stop buying Russian oil might be untrue. And I have seen reports that India's ambassador to Moscow, Mr. Kumar, has also spoken about this. And he has apparently, in discussions, I presume, on the Russian media, which, by the way, I cannot find, but apparently he has actually denied that the Indians have at any point told the Americans that India is going to stop definitely buying Russian oil. Anyway, coming back to the Geneva discussions, it seems that the Ukrainians were indeed shocked by the Russians' stance. And that explains the bizarre behavior of Zelensky in the following hours. Zelensky is incredibly coarse and crude language in his statements to Axios and in his interview with Piers Morgan. He's a profligate use of four-letter words, one in particular. I'm not sure what... Anyway, just to say. Clearly the Ukrainians are very shaken by it. It looks as if they were perhaps telling themselves, despite the fact that they don't like Medinsky, that maybe, just maybe, the fact that the Russians are negotiating might mean that they're prepared to be more flexible on some things, like perhaps the Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. Now, I come now to the view, somewhat going back on some of the things I said in my video yesterday, that this is what lies behind the private meeting between the two chief Ukrainian negotiators, Umerov, who is Ukraine's present chief negotiator, and Arakhamia, who was Ukraine's chief negotiator in 2022, who negotiated at that time with Medinsky. I suspect that this explains the meeting between these two people and Medinsky that took place later in the Intercontinental Hotel. I think that after Zelensky learnt What a tough line Medinsky was taking. He contacted Umerov and Arakhamiya and said, is it really as bad as it looks? Are the Russians, for example, really ruling out any ceasefire at all, including a ceasefire in the sky, which I have no doubt that the Ukrainians brought up? After all, their energy system has been pounded, not entirely out of existence, but approaching that point. Can you see whether in private, away from the formal meetings, when the Americans are away, Medinsky and the Russians might be willing to show just a little bit more flexibility? And I think this is probably what happened with Umerov and Arakhamiya contacting Medinsky, asking him to go back, having this further private two-hour meeting with him to see what exactly it was, whether what Medinsky said in the formal sessions was for the American consumption, or whether when the Americans were not there, the message might be a bit softer. And judging from Zelensky's reaction, his furious interviews, his profligate use of four-letter words, it's absolutely clear that Medinsky made clear during the private meeting that what he was saying in the formal sessions represents the actual Russian position. Now, here I'm going to say something further. There's been much discussion about whether the Russians have hardened their terms over the last few weeks. I believe that since the Valdai attack, they probably have. Others doubt this. There's been some very interesting interactions about this. There's also been a lot of speculation about Putin's own position. For the record, I still believe that the Russians have hardened their terms, and quite probably this was conveyed both to the Americans and to the Ukrainians during the session in Geneva. But putting that aside, one thing I am sure, and that is that Medinsky, tough negotiator that he is, Russian nationalist to his fingertips that he also is his master's voice. In other words, what he said in the negotiations is what Vladimir Putin instructed him to say. I don't believe otherwise. If Medinsky took a very hard line over the discussions, over the course of the discussions in Geneva, he was doing so on Putin's instructions, and the Russians have themselves said that throughout the course of the negotiations in Geneva, Putin was there with the secure phone beside him, supervising the Russian conduct of the negotiations as it was taking place. Quite likely, he was being kept updated every moment that the negotiations were underway. I say this because always people speculate about Putin. They assume that he's going to suddenly cave to what the Americans want, that he's prepared to cut some grand economic bargain with the Americans, in other words, accept the American bribes Dmitriev has now refuted that, and about the conduct of the meeting in Geneva. Well, I think we can see the same. So there it is, an incredibly tough position from the Russians, and one, an unyielding one. And I don't see any reason why the Russians should change their stance now. I do sense that there has been a hardening of the Russian line, and I think that is going to continue. And I think speculation that Putin is going to cave at some point is groundless and wrong, and it is frustrating that it continues to circulate. Similarly, speculation that Russia is under extraordinary economic pressure and that the governor of the Russian Central Bank, Elvira Nabiullina, has told Putin that unless there is peace in Ukraine by November, then the Russian economy is going to fall into recession. Well, all I could say about that is that I've just been looking at Nabiullina's comments as posted on the website of the Russian Central Bank shortly after the central bank made its recent decision to cut interest rates from 16% to 15.5%. I can't see even a glimmer of a sign that Nabiullina thinks anything of that sort, or that she gave advice of that kind to Vladimir Putin. I read an extraordinary article in The Economist, which also said that the Russian economy is cannibalizing itself and is now in a period of serial decline. I really do not understand where people who say things like this are getting this information outside their own imaginations. Because if you look at every single comment that Russian officials make, every single comment that Russian economic commentators and the Russian media is full of about the economy, certainly if you look at the things that Nabiullina herself is saying, well, you see things that are not only totally different, but different in a way that the events of the last 4 years has consistently shown to be true. Now, again, I should just say that there's been more comments about the economy today. Dmitry Medvedev, the vice chairman of the Security Council, has now weighed in. He makes comments about how Russia is behind in some areas of microelectronics, that other Russian officials have said that Russia is now re-establishing its position in the area of microelectronics, producing chips and that kind of thing, how Russia was one of the leaders in the 1970s, but that it lost that position of leadership in the 1980s, but now it is coming back. Medvedev says, fine, that's good, but we're nowhere near moving forward with this fast enough. That's the kind of actual economic debate that's taking place in Russia, not debate about an imminent economic collapse. I'm just saying. Now, the other narrative that is being promoted relentlessly across the media in the West, at least the European media at the moment, is that the Russians are at a standstill in the war, that they're not advancing, that the Ukrainians have achieved some great success in this counterattack in Zaporozhye, that they have recaptured more territory in Zaporozhye over the last few days, weeks, than they've managed to capture since their summer 2023 offensive. I wonder why people bring up the summer 2023 offensive in that way, given that for Ukraine, that particular offensive was a total disaster. Just saying. But anyway, I read all of this. Alexander Stubb is talking in that way. Some people in Germany continue to talk in that way. All sorts of people in Europe continue to write this. Julian Repke had built Zeitung, says that the entire ongoing current Zaporozhye, Ukrainian Zaporozhye counteroffensive is mostly fiction. I believe it. I agree with him. He is, remember, the single most reliable Western journalist covering the war in Ukraine. And of course, he's a fervid supporter of Ukraine, as I have pointed out several times. The Russians are saying that all Ukrainian counterattacks in eastern Ukraine have been repulsed and that the Russians are now preparing for a further major advance westwards towards Orekhov and Zaporozhye city itself. There are claims that a little further north, the Ukrainians are still on the attack and that they're trying to capture the village that the Russians captured some months ago called Uspenovka. I think that all of these attacks here are largely fiction. There is a massive shortage of drone footage. There's been claims that in some of these places, the Ukrainians are sending robots, which is to say remote controlled vehicles. And it is these rather than actual infantry that are present in some of these places, which strongly suggests to me, if true, that the Ukrainians really don't control the territory here. Otherwise, why send robots instead of actual infantry? But anyway, that's the reports. Those are the stories that the Ukrainians are circulating. But I don't believe in the truth of these either. In fact, and in reality, it is the Russians who continue to advance. And there are reports from the Russian side that the offensive in Konstantinovka is continuing. I believe, by the way, and for the record, that the maps that the various mapping projects have about the situation in Konstantinovka are out of date and wrong. I believe that southwestern Konstantinovka is mostly, though not entirely, under Russian control, that the Russians control the central part of Konstantinovka, and that we will suddenly find that the situation for the Ukrainians in Konstantinovka has become as critical as the situation for the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk became around late October, November of last year. And as happened with Pokrovsk, when that happens in Konstantinovka, it will come as a major surprise. There's also further reports that the Russians not only have occupied more of Liman, where the Ukrainians are putting up resistance, apparently because all the lines of retreat have been closed, but we now have the first video footage showing Russian flags being raised in the town of Sviatogorsk to the north of Liman. Sviatogorsk, another one of the places that the Russians captured briefly in 2022, but the Ukrainians recaptured in the autumn of 2022 during the Kharkiv counteroffensive, but it looks as if it's slipping back under Russian control. Anyway, I will do a more detailed discussion of the situation on the front lines later in another program. But for the moment, it's perhaps worth discussing an operational update of the situation in the war provided by the operations chief of the Russian General Staff, General Alexander Rutskoy. Now, General Rutskoy has been there throughout the entire period of the special military operation. I remember he gave a very interesting update about the state of the war in March 2022, by the way, where, by the way, he also provided an update as to actual Russian casualties, which was a small fraction of those being claimed in the West at that time. But that was late March 2022, just before the Istanbul Agreement was initialed and just before the Russians withdrew from Kiev. Just saying. Anyway, Rutskoy is back. He's been back several times since 2022, but he's provided an interesting update. First of all, he has given figures for Ukrainian losses. He claims that over the course of the period of the special military operation, total Ukrainian losses have been 1.5 million. Zelensky says 55,000 killed. As I understand it, Rutskoy is talking about total Ukrainian losses. So this includes wounded, but obviously we're talking about entirely different numbers, not just from those Zelensky is giving, but from those that we normally see in the West. I am not in a position to either corroborate or refute Rutskoy's claims. Maybe rather than focus on the numbers that he is giving, we should look instead at the trends. Because according to Rutskoy, of those 1.5 million casualties which he claims the Ukrainians suffered, a third, half a million, were suffered by the Ukrainians last year, in 2025. Last year was, according to Rutskoy, for the Ukrainians, the worst year by far of the war. And given that Mediazona is showing a fall in Russian losses in 2025, in fact, they have fallen significantly in 2025, according to Mediazona. If what Rutskoy is saying is true, then the gap between the Russians and the Ukrainians in terms of losses is increasing prodigiously. And the situation is getting very, very bad for the Ukrainians indeed. Here, I should say that various Ukrainian commanders have, in the last 2 weeks, been coming out and making statements that Ukrainian claims and Western claims about Russian losses are grossly inflated and wrong and should not be heeded. You can find all about this if you go to the blogs of Simplicius the Thinker and the blogger I Know His Events in Ukraine. They reproduce these statements by Ukrainians. Anyway, this isn't the only thing that Rutskoy said. Rutskoy said that as a result of these enormous losses, the Ukrainian army is now shrinking. It is not able to replace losses. And the size discrepancy between the Russians and the Ukrainians is increasing. He also said that the Russians hold the initiative on every part of the contact line. Now, this was by far the most upbeat report that Rutskoy has provided, giving an overview of the state of the war up to this time. I've already discussed how all the indications to me suggest that the Russians are preparing some big offensive in the spring. The Institute for the Study of War says the same, and there's been discussions about where the blow will fall. I think what Rutskoy is saying suggests that what the Russians are preparing is a knockout blow, that they believe that Ukraine will not be able to withstand this next big offensive that the Russians are about to launch. Well, we will see if they are right, but that's what I think that they are thinking. And that, of course, no doubt explains the partly explains the toughness and the confidence that Medinsky showed during the talks in Geneva. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, Substack, and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, where, by the way, we're doing a major promotion, and you can find all sorts of things at significant discounts at the present time. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this platform, to this channel. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.